You may think if you want to figure out what the future of the web is, you would look at web standards that are being developed, right? And say, oh, look, here's a wonderful web standard under development. That must be the future of the web. That's the next big thing. And you're right. So what do you think? Don't even try it. So now you didn't get to see the beautiful opening slide. It has my name on it and everything. It's fantastic. All right, so you may look and say, hey, I just want to see what's next out there, and that's going to give me an indication of where web is going. Well, it's not always a good thing to do. We've got many standards out there today that have been started to be implemented and have never finished the implementation. And frankly, I tried to pull some really old ones out that are like at least 3 years old that show you these things might be started and never be implemented. So just because something is a spec doesn't mean that it's going to end up to be a feature of the web. In fact, we have a number of specs out there today, and we can probably add to this list of ones that are not recommended to implement at all. Touch Inputs was a fantastic web spec that was out there in the W3C for a very short time, implemented quite often, and then found to have some sort of IP infringement. So it was taken off the list and made not a recommendation to implement. App cache is one that almost every browser out there implemented, and now they're calling it a douchebag, which is really unfair because it was a fantastic spec for its time, but it just didn't grow with the web, so the recommendation is to actually not implement app cache. Same thing with some of the other ones that we see out there. So what we see in the spec world is not necessarily where the web is going. Now, this guy right here, do you recognize him? Maybe this will help. Now it looks familiar? Well, Mr. Peter here got in a little bit of heat with some of the browser vendors for suggesting we take a slower pace at spec development and get more on the same page, because we are seeing such a diverse implementation across different browsers as to what specs are being implemented and how much energy is putting behind them. And that makes it hard for us as web developers to know where we're looking, right? To know where we're going, because if you look at one browser, you might see one future and another browser and see another future. So I actually want to take us back to HTML5 at its earliest stage. When the charter was made for HTML5, there was a line in there saying that HTML5 should be paving the cow paths. Okay, and I'm from Texas, so I feel quite qualified to talk about cows and cow paths. So this is how it works. A cow finds the easiest road, the easiest point from point A to point B. He'll find the easiest path there, and he will take that path. And then all the other cows will take that path, and pretty soon, it's a cow path. Well, then the cow path is there, and then men start walking on the cow path because that's the easiest way to walk from point A to point B. And then because men on it go on it, then wagons go on it. And because wagons go on it, then we pave it and turn it into a road. And then 50 to 100 years later, you have San Francisco with the wavy roads going down the hills. So that's how it works. That's how a cow path works. We want the same thing in the web. We want to look where developers are going, what they're already doing out there, and then make it easy on the web. Make it work faster, make it easier to implement, and make it standardized so you only have to do it one way everywhere. So what I want to do today is I want to look at a couple technologies that are out there and exciting today, and look at where the web is going to move towards them. Now, I'll be honest, I'm not going to cover everything that could be new and exciting out there, but a couple ones that I think are important to the way that we build web applications. Okay, so we're going to look at the three different areas. One of them is the immersion. We hear a lot about VR and AR and mixed reality and how the heck we're going to get that on the web. The second one is engagement. All right, we want to be able to build applications that work like native apps so users can install them and uninstall them and put them on their desktop and have them run offline and be able to get push messages from them and all those great things. And the last thing is we want our applications to be intelligent. They have to be smarter than they are today. They have to be able to understand new forms of input. So let's start by looking at engagement. One of my favorite quotes out there by Mr. William Shakespeare, we may know this part by heart. All the world's a stage and the men and women are merely players. What you don't know is the part that's not quite as popular that follows that. It goes something like this. And you know it's true because he signed the bottom of the slide, right? So, but that's where we're going. The web is the world's biggest app store, just waiting to happen. And it's already easier to search, easier to navigate to, and easier to link back and forth between different properties. So it's set up for the perfect environment for users. Now I'll admit, there are many benefits that you get from a native application today that you don't get from a web app. So I made this handy chart here to help us identify what is what. Web apps are cross-platform, which is awesome. If you work in an environment where you have to maintain code bases for multiple platforms, you're not alone. That's how most people work, and it's a real pain. Practically every customer, every partner that I go and sit down and talk with, one of their questions is about cross-platform development. They're looking for a way that they can build one app that's going to work everywhere. Web apps are online. They're always live. They always give you the most recent version of the application. And they're linkable. You can click on a link in one application, and it'll take you to a new web page. And it'll take you over to that content, and you can type in the URL and get there yourself. It's very easy to navigate from one to the other. Native apps, on the other hand, have some very handy features that we wish we had on the web today. So hardware access is one of them, right? We always want to use that one API that doesn't exist on the web today. Sometimes it's Bluetooth. Sometimes it's access to the user's contacts. Whatever it is, we wish we had it. Offline first, it would be really great if the web just worked offline and it was really easy to make our apps be both always up to date and offline. Discoverable through app stores. I don't know about you, but in every place that I've ever worked, they've always wanted to have an app in the app store. No matter how wonderful and featureful our website was, there's still a marketing side that says we need to have our name in the app store and it has to be popular and it has to have 4.5 stars and people have to put smiley faces in the reviews whenever they download my app. And the last thing is that you want to be able to run in the background, okay? Native apps can do that today. They can run processes even when you don't have it open. A browser, on the other hand, once your user leaves your web page, you've lost them. They've linked on to the next one. So sometimes the good things are the bad things. So what we want to do is figure out, how do we do this? Do we move the good stuff about the web and put it into native apps? Or do we want to take the good stuff from native and put it in the web apps? Well, Google announced earlier this year at Google I.O. Instant Apps, which is basically you go to a web page, and then instead of giving them your web page, they just instantly download an app for you and show it to you in the app. It's getting mixed reviews from the audience, and I don't blame them. Because generally, if I want to install an app, I want to go to the store and intentfully install it, not have it installed on my behalf. So I'm thinking that this probably isn't the way that we want to go. Although I'm sure every platform, including Microsoft, would love to have an experience where all the developers build an app just for our platform and not the other platforms. So if I can talk you out of writing apps for iOS and Android, let me know, but I don't foresee that coming. So instead, what if we do the opposite and we say, let's take the really cool parts of native apps and build them into web apps today. And that's what we want to do. So let's start off by talking about progressive web apps. How many have heard that term before? Progressive web apps? Okay, I have a whole talk on this tomorrow, so I'm not going to go too in depth, but I want to show you what it looks like, because it's really important to kind of grasp that idea of what our web apps are going to look like in the future. So progressive web apps is a title that, give credit where credit is due, Google came up with this to explain where they're going with applications on the web. And I think it's really awesome, the idea of keeping apps progressive, so layering on functionality as it's available instead of stripping down functionality for people who don't have the newest devices. I think it's a great way to approach this. But when they talk about this, they're generally talking about a couple different features, a couple different specs put together. And the first one is the W3C manifest. Okay, W3C manifest is the idea that we are going to have one manifest for the web that will work on all the different platforms. Okay, so admittedly, today you have a manifest that works to build a Windows app, you have a manifest that works that builds a Chrome app, you have a manifest that works to build a Firefox app, and there are tons of other platforms out there that are web platforms that have their own manifests as well. So the idea is that we get it to the point where it's just one manifest, and it's JSON-based, and it's really easy for us as web developers to write and manage. The second one is service workers. So service workers, it's a web worker that runs independently of the page. All right, so a service worker can do things like handle web requests, which means it can act as a proxy server for your website. It can be running in the background, so it could get a push notification even when a user isn't on your website. And it can cache the requests that come in so that your web page can work offline, just like it does when it's online. And the last one we'll talk about is the app container. Okay, so the app container is how we present all of this to a user. They know what it looks like in a browser, but what does it look like as an app? Okay, how do we give you unlimited storage? How do we let you run in the background? How do we let a user install and uninstall you? All right, that's all part of the app container strategy. Okay, so, see, I told you I'm not good with slides. All right, let's first start off and look at some service workers, okay? So I've got a site set up already here. Is that clear? You can see that? Yep. Okay, and what it is it is a video site. Ignore that, that's not part of this demo. You have to come tomorrow to see the good stuff. Okay, so this is the video site that lets you browse the different titles. Okay, it lets you watch the videos. And it's responsive, so it will adjust to all the different screen sizes. It works with touch, so it has all of those qualities that we would want in an application, which makes it a good place to start for a progressive web app, because it has what you would expect, what a user would expect from an application. So this is going to kind of be our demo app today. Now, what I want to do is I'm going to show you how Service Workers works here first. So to do that, I'm going to move over to Chrome. They have the very best implementation out there today of Service Workers. And we're going to run this app here. Now, the first thing, remember, your apps should all be cross-platform, so you should have a really great experience on all the browsers, including Chrome. So I want this app to run in the background. Now, I have already attached a service worker to it. And let me show you how that happens. I'm going to pull up my index page here. I am first feature detecting that I have service worker support. All right, that's very important for using these technologies in a progressive web app, because otherwise this would air out if I didn't have service workers. So I'm testing, I'm doing a feature detection saying, yes, I have service workers. So I'm going to do a couple things. I'm going to request permission for notifications, and then I'm going to register my service worker. So this is me saying, okay, service worker, you are now attached to this page. And I'll get in much more detail on this tomorrow. But I'm going to then attach this service worker that looks something like this. Okay? So the service worker has a couple parts to it. The first one is a cache. And if you look at the very top line, you'll see my cache name. That's me identifying my cache for this site. I'm saying, okay, this is the cache that I'm going to put all my files in. I'm then going to list the files that I want to add to the cache ahead of time. And that's right here. This is an array, my required files array. And I'm listing all of the different files that I'm using on my website. Now, I could actually wait and look to see what files download, but I want to cache them ahead of time if I can, right? So that I have the very best experience for the users. The next thing I do is I move on to the install event of the service worker. So this happens once in the lifecycle of a service worker. It installs, and this is where I'm going to open my cache and then add all of my files to it. Now, as soon as I add them all in, it goes out and makes network requests and pull in as many of those files as it can and stuffs them into the cache. Okay, so this happens, and I don't want to do that every time I load the page and load the service worker, because then that would be just as much network traffic as loading the page. This is supposed to be making it perform faster, so I do it once here. So that's what happens on the install event. The next thing I do, and this is where a little bit of the magic happens, I have an event listener set for fetch. Fetch is a very interesting new feature that is being implemented in the latest Evergreen browsers. And what it does is it fires an event every time a network request is made. So you can use fetch directly, and I can say, fetch this file, and it'll go and get it. But it'll also fire this event when I load an image, or I make an XHR call, or I load the page. So what I'm doing with fetch is I'm listening to this event, all right, and then I'm looking at the response, and I'm seeing if it is in the cache. If the response is in the cache, and by the way, when you stick something in the cache, you stick the whole request in, not just the response body. So it has the headers and everything in the cache, which means I can pull it out and it looks like a request that came from the network. It doesn't look like a local file, which is really awesome. So I look and see if it matches, and if it does match, then I return it from the cache instead of the network. So fetch never makes a network request. It hits that event and it stops, it checks the cache. If it's in the cache, it pulls it out of there instead of making the network call. So now we have two things going on. One is we've got a page that's loading really fast because it's pulling everything from its local cache, which, by the way, cache is not the same as browser cache. Your browser cache is something that's controlled by the system and the user, and it's there, it's not there, it's there, it's not there. This is cache for developers. This is you control this. Okay, you decide what goes in there, you decide when you pull something out of it. All right? So I'm saving all that time, so now it's really fast, and when I'm offline, I can just pull the stuff from the cache instead of making a network call, so I never need to really even know that I'm offline. So the last thing that we are going to do, this activate, this is fire an event so that I know that my service worker is ready. And the last thing I'm going to do is I have a message set up, and I'm just going to kind of go over this quickly today, but a message set up so that I can talk back and forth between my service worker and my page. Okay, I can pass messages back and forth. And that's it. That's all I have. This is like less than 100 lines of code here that I added to my site. And I really haven't done much else to my site. I didn't change the way I built it. I'm still using images, and I'm still using XHR, and I'm still doing all that kind of stuff. All right, now I'm going to load up this page. Actually, let me reset it. And I do this here by stopping and unregistering the service worker. Okay. All right, so I got my message. This is what the event was responding to, saying, yes, service workers are cached. Now look at my tools here at my console. You see a message that says the service worker is attached. If you go back to my code, I have a really important inside the fetch here, console log, that when the response is being pulled from the cache, I throw out a console log that it's pulling it from the cache. So this first time, I pulled it from the server. I didn't pull it from the cache. Now when I refresh the page, you see what happens. All of these files are being pulled from my cache. It was really quick, right? In fact, it actually takes longer to unload the page than to reload it, which is really cool. It works the same way. Okay. All of the same. This is me, by the way. I moonlight, do different roles. It's pretty cool. So I am using my cache. Now watch what happens whenever I turn my server off. The same thing happens because I'm still pulling it from the cache. All right, so now I have a system that works offline. I have a system that is pulling, it's optimized for speed. I can even run things in the background. Now, I'm going to click on this where it says save this video for offline, and it's going to use that post message to make a request to download the video file that I'm playing here, and then save it off locally. It's then going to fire a notification. All right? Now, what I want to do is I'm going to click this, and then really quickly, I'm going to navigate away so you can see what happens. I'm not on the page anymore. If this was a normal web page, it would have canceled. But instead, it continued to download my file, added it to the cache, and when it was done, it sent me a toast notification letting me know that it was done. So it's working in the background. It's working offline. This is like where our web apps are going. Okay, so now that's service workers. Let's move on to the manifest because this is really important as well. The W3C manifest is where I'm going to put all of the information about my app. This is going to describe it. It's the metadata for your app. So it's going to have things like the start URL. And by the way, everything is optional. So it's going to have the start URL. It's then going to have the scope. Tells me when my app starts and when my app stops. It's going to have all of my images and things like that. Okay, and then this is what I'm going to use to formulate those apps. It's going to tell me how it's going to be displayed. You add this to your web server. You maintain it along your other code. All right, and then your browser or your search engine, whatever it is that's going to be looking for this app signal, will pick that up and keep it up to date. So you just deploy it with regular files. The last thing that we want to see is the app container. All right, so for this part, I'm going to switch to the live version of this site. Okay, so this is the same thing out there running on an Azure website. I'm going to use a tool that I self-promoting that I work on called Manifold.js that helps generate what we call hosted web apps. Okay, what very similar to what Google calls progressive web apps, generates hosted web apps for all the different platforms. It basically creates the container for all the different platforms, iOS, Android, Windows 10, and number of other platforms as well. So because of the time, I'm going to quickly go through here. Find one that it's not there. Okay. So it's a command line tool. I'm going to paste in the URL. And then I'm going to limit the platform to Windows 10 so that it just moves fast. And this is going to go out. It's going to look at that W3C manifest, pick out all that information, and then it's going to generate the app. Okay, so when we're done, we end up with a Windows 10 folder. If there were other platforms, they'd be there as well. The manifest itself, information on where to submit it, and even source code if you want to open it up in Visual Studio and use it for debugging and stuff like that, which is really powerful. So when I run it, it's going, Windows 20. Don't want to give out any secrets. And of course, it's not going to work here. I think my file path is too long. Sorry, guys. So it's going to install, and it's basically going to take that app, and it's going to create a container. Now, if I do this in Chrome today, it kind of sucks, all right? Because what happens is Chrome will create a shortcut for me, okay? And it'll link out to that. And then if I do the shortcut, all right, which is this here, and do something like uninstall, and go down to uninstall, it actually goes and takes me to uninstall Google Chrome, which is a fabulous idea. You should all do that, okay? But it's not what I had intended when I clicked on that. Now, the other thing is whenever it is running, if I look at like the task manager, I just see Google Chrome, okay? I don't see an independent app. Now, what we're doing on Windows 10, though, is actually having an app container. So you see I have a Southridge app here. It's a sandboxed application like all the other Windows 10 apps. It has access to unlimited storage like the other Windows 10 apps, I mean physical memory withstanding. It can be backgrounded, it can be sandboxed, or excuse me, it can be tombstoned, whatever it can wants to run in the background, it can run in the background. And then if I want to get rid of it, it's going to act like any other app. I can just go and uninstall it, okay? So this is an app package. It looks just like an app. And this is where we're going. So now let's imagine that we have all of these things together. We have service workers like the way that it works in Chrome, an app container like the way it works in Windows 10. We basically have everything from both columns of the list, right? So we can provide great experiences for our users written in web technologies that work across platforms, and you only have to write it once. All right? That's where we're going with apps. Now, I talked really long on that, so the next thing that I want to talk about is intelligence, building intelligence into our applications. So I'm going to use a bot for this. Okay, bots get kind of a bad name because if you go onto any travel website or any store today, once you're on there for about 30 seconds, some picture with probably some adorable girl is going to pop up and she's going to have a headset like this on and it's going to say, hey, how can I help you? And you're going to like talk to six levels of machine that are looking for a single keyword and it's going to be a horrible experience and you're never going to want to shop there again. So that's what I think of when I think of bots. Now, I've dug into bots a little bit and found out that the real key to that is intelligence. So I'm actually using Azure Cognitive Services, is that what we call it? The Lewis Project, which is natural language understanding. All right? So this is what See, I told you I would skip out of the decks. It's not. I'm like 200 slides behind. It's perfect. Okay, so if I'm writing an old-fashioned bot, this is what I basically am doing. I'm going through there and I'm doing regular expressions that looks for keywords and then matches it. And if it finds that keyword, then it knows what you're asking for. So if I say, I'm looking for the word books, and then you type in, I'm looking for books, it will know what you want. If you type in, I'm looking for something to read, it will have no idea what you're talking about. Okay, so it needs to be able to understand language. So that's one of the things that Lewis brings for us. All right, so I think I can start over here. What you can do is you can actually go in today and open this free account with the natural language Lewis.ai. And the first thing that you're going to do is you're going to set up an application. All right? And then you're going to start training that application. Now, I have taken it upon myself to build a bot that understands the depth of the best and most intricate conversation ever. That's this. Have you ever, do you remember Princess Bride? Princess Bride fans in here? Okay, who has not seen The Princess Bride? Oh, see, my wife told me. She's like, it's an American thing. No one's going to understand over there. I think she's right. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. I brought a link. It's the battle of the wits between the man in black and Vincini. Oh. And I didn't plug the sound in. Okay, do you recognize it now? Does that help any context? All right, so what I want to do is I want to be able to have a conversation with this guy. Where I'm going to be able to talk to him and he's going to understand what I'm asking. So the first thing that I want to do is I want to say hi, and he's going to say
Inconceivable.
inconceivable, because that's what Vincini says whenever he doesn't know what else to say. Now, I want to ask him something like, are you really that smart? Perfect. That made it worse. Didn't help. Okay, that's fine. It's fine. We're gonna move on. So what I need him to do is I need him to be able to understand different ways that I'm gonna say the same thing. All right? So I think I have lost audio altogether now. So yeah. Yeah, see this? It's okay. It's all right. We don't need it. It was just for theatrical effect, so we'll be fine without it. So I want to be able to say, how smart are you, okay? And he's going to tell me how smart he is. Now, I also want to be able to say, how intelligent are you, okay? Because that's another way of saying it. And I should be able to spell it wrong, right? And he's not going to know what I mean. Okay, so what we need to do is we need to actually go in and program him a little bit. So when I go into my settings here for my app, it actually has, instead of matching word, it has phrases, okay? And then the phrase is going to be identified. It'll be tied to different utterances that represent that. So it's... So I have my different intents here. They call them intents, not phrases. And though the different phrases are going to be able to be programmed, and I can show you what some of those look like. For example, if I say we were looking for how smart are you? Okay. How smart are you? Okay. I taught it that. And then it said, so you think you are smart. Okay. I taught it that. So I'm going to say, so you think you are smart. Now notice I spelled think wrong, right? But it was still able to figure it out. So maybe I'll say something like, so you're that smart. It's still going to come back and recognize what that is. What happens is you start to teach it some phrases, and then it starts to learn phrases on its own. It uses that. Now let me take you over to the phrases that it didn't know. All right, so these are the different phrases that it heard and it guessed. So we were looking at R smart is the name of the intents. And these different things had different levels of confidence of what it was. So it said, so you're that smart, all right? Poor grammar here. It knew exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what it meant. It was one. It was 100% sure that's what it was. You're that smart. You are that smart. It figured that out on its own. All right. It was able to learn that. Then there were also other things like let's begin that it was like, I have a little bit of a chance that that's what you mean. And when it says let's begin, that actually is a different utterance. Okay. So that is actually pour the wine. All right. Which it didn't think it was. So I'm going to teach it. That's what it was. And through time, it starts to guess these things on itself. You can actually do some performance analysis to help it figure out how well it's doing at guessing based on whether you tell it it's right through these guesses. So the more times I tell it whether it's right or wrong, the more it's able to figure out what people mean when they're saying different utterances. Okay? So now we have a web that is intelligent, that can understand input. This isn't just for text. I'm using it for text, but it can be for pictures. It can be for content. It can analyze code and things like that and be able to derive what people mean whenever they have certain types of input. So a very powerful tool that's going to make the web smarter and smarter. Now, in the last 5 minutes, we're really short here on time, but I still want to talk about an immersive web. Because this is one of the things that's very important to the experience of the user. We see a lot of VR and AR out there, and we actually can participate in that as well. So WebGL, we're actually in version 2 right now, is the basis for being able to create hardware-accelerated graphics on the web. so we can create experiences that previously would be way too powerful to be able to run inside of a browser. So specifically, let's see if I can find it here. Sponza is the one I want to show you. So Sponza is an old Croatian castle that was recreated in this web environment here. It gives you the ability to walk through it and explore it and look at the different architecture right through your browser. And once it loads, you'll see that it's hardware accelerated. We're actually working with Babylon right now to put service workers in there as well so that it can use that to cache some of its images and things. All right, so we have this nice hardware-accelerated 3D experience in our browser. I'm going to go ahead and click on the camera, which gives my browser the control of the camera. I can now look around and see the environment. I can move through it, look at the different parts of it. All right, so it's nice. It's hardware-accelerated. It can do 30, 60 frames per second. There's actually a standard now called WebVR, which takes an experience like this and gives us the ability to present it in a 3D virtual reality environment. Now, for WebVR to function, you need a little bit of hardware access on the device itself, okay? So you need to be able to tell that the device is moving, right? So we need to be able to have accelerometer data. And what WebVR does is it takes that accelerometer data and it turns it into something meaningful for the VR space. So I actually have an app here. What is that app called? Present my Windows Phone. It's called It's been a long day. Project. Project my screen. There it is. So it works perfect on a device like a phone, okay? Now, I don't have the headset up here, but you'll get the idea. I'm going to open my Sponza app here. We're going to get that same 3D environment on the phone. But then on here, we will actually want to go into VR mode. So what we actually need to do is be able to identify what each eye is seeing individually instead of looking at it as a single camera. So it's basically taking what we're doing for VR with a single camera and moving it to a dual camera mode, one for each eye. So I'm going to go out of the mode here, and then I'm going to turn on the VR camera. Okay. Now when I move the device around, when I project, it gets really bad frame rate. Sorry about that. But you can see I now have an experience that will cater to the virtual reality devices. And this is something that's showing on a phone tied in with my browser. This is not going to be the greatest experience, but the same thing can happen with your full virtual reality headsets. Now, one of the things that is really lacking from this, however, is WebVR doesn't have any tie-in to augmented reality, okay? And the reason is that we need to have placeholders, right? We need to be able to tie into physical things. So that would mean that we would have to be able to have markers that work with it. I'll show you what I mean. So Come on. Okay. I'm not going to show you what I mean. I'll tell you what I mean. So the virtual reality environments need to be able to lay over real things. Okay, and that's one of the things that separates the mixed and the augmented reality from the virtual reality, is being able to overlay them on real world objects. There's nothing in the spec today that makes that happen. All right, so there's still a gap between where we want to go with the web and what we have in the spec. And I would encourage you to reach out to the spec makers, just like I am, and tell them, if that's something that you want to be able to do, that that's a feature request that you have for that. So next steps for us. Some of this is things that you can do today. And take the progressive web app as kind of the format of how we need to move forward. We have fantastic app containers on Windows 10. We have fantastic service workers on Android and Chrome. So instead of waiting for all of those things to land together, take advantage of the app containers on Windows 10. Take advantage of service workers. And then whenever they start being supported on other platforms, your app will just continue to get better and better for the users. Same thing with virtual reality. You can build with WebGL today. There's ways that you can do embedded objects, you can do full screen experiences, and then as the specs progress to be able to add that virtual reality and hopefully augmented reality someday, you'll be ready for it. I have some links that you can follow, some of the frameworks that we use today to build this, and hopefully get you moving in the same direction as where I see the future of the web. So thank you so much for sticking around today, guys. Hope you have a good night.